Welcome to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. Today we'll hear what New Jersey Governor Mikey Sherrill has to say about the growing concerns surrounding World Cup matches in New Jersey.
When it comes to moving people into the game at the FIFA World Cup, and FIFA intends to make about $11 billion on this, they need to defray this cost. So we've already reached out to them saying, look, this is going to cost about $50 million to move people.
We continue to celebrate Jazz Appreciation Month, dipping into the WBGO archives for an interview with pianist Monty Alexander.
If I'm having a blues, a bad day, feeling low about something, I know if I go play tonight, goodbye blues.
And WBGO's John Kalish has the first of a two-part series on the Jersey Devil.
The search for creatures like the Jersey Devil is referred to as cryptozoology.
All this coming up today on the WBGO Journal. 8 World Cup matches will be played at MetLife Stadium in East Rutherford starting in June. But after the state touted all the success of bringing such an event to the Garden State, officials are now facing big concerns about traffic and costs associated with going to the matches. On this week's WBGO call-in show, Ask Governor Sherrill, New Jersey Governor Mikey Sherrill spoke with host Michael Hill about what are the biggest issues they're facing.
Here's something on the minds of many New Jersey and people in the region. It's the World Cup. This is a global event that draws billions of viewers. It's landing at the Meadowlands in 2 months. And tonight, New Jersey Transit is weighing a $100 round-trip train ticket to the World Cup Games, barring regular commuters from the NJ Transit area of Penn Station for hours each month. How are New Jerseyans who depend on NJ Transit going to get around during all of this?
There are 2 days that I'm particularly concerned about because the games fall right in some of our peak commuting hours. So at that time, we're going to make sure we support extra services across the board. So if you're generally taking the one route that's going now to be going into the stadium, we'll have extra services on the path and busing so that you can get home effectively and quickly. But at the same time, I wanted to make sure that none of this cost is borne by New Jerseyans, because this is a huge event. I think we're going to get a lot of returns on investment. We're going to see a lot of small businesses with extra business, especially at a time when we're feeling the tightening of the economy. Costs have gone up with Trump's illegal tariff plan, for example, gas prices because of his war. So here's an opportunity to really invest in the economy of New Jersey. But at the same time, when it comes to moving people into the game at the FIFA World Cup, and FIFA intends to make about $11 billion on this, they need to defray this cost. So we've already reached out to them saying, look, this is going to cost about $50 million to move people. And other than raising the ticket price, you know, to get on the train ticket, which I will if that's what it takes, because I'm not putting it on the back of New Jerseyans, the best possible outcome would really be for FIFA to take on this cost.
And what about, since there's not going to be any parking at the stadium, there's a potential for people to be taking Uber and Lyft and other rideshare vehicles there. Are we prepared for that?
So you're exactly right. FIFA has said no parking. So again, I think that's why totally appropriate for them to take on then the transit costs, because that's how people are going to get in and out for the most part. At the same time, there are Uber and Lyft services in certain areas. That's going to be, it's going to be easier to get in and out on the train service. But we're trying to prepare for everything. And we have, I have to say, Chris Calori of NJ Transit has been fantastic. Our state troopers and Homeland Security, everyone has been working together incredibly well to make sure that we are trying to address any possible contingency so we have a fantastic World Cup here in New Jersey.
The Bergen Record reported that normal commuters are going to be barred from NJ Transit area of Penn Station for 4 hours leading up to each of the 8 matches at MetLife Stadium this June and July. How are regular commuters possibly going to deal with that logistically? How is this going to work?
So we have been, you know, this feels like a military operation from my days in the Navy with the logistics that we are dealing with. This will probably be the largest amount of people that have ever been moved in our country in this short a period of time between such a, you know, in this distance. So we're working incredibly hard to make sure that we do that safely and thoughtfully, that, again, It doesn't cost New Jersey taxpayers any money. And so for the most part, I think we can do this in a way that is not going to have a huge impact on the commute because it'll be outside of normal commuting times. There are the two games that I'm very focused on. We are pushing in extra resources on the PATH system, et cetera, so that commuters will know exactly how to get home that day and how to do that very effectively as we move so many people. Because, as I said, FIFA has said no parking, which is, as people who go to MetLife Stadium frequently know, normally there's parking there, as well as the fact that we really, I think, you know, need them to start to get engaged here on this cost.
I'm really interested in how something's going to be enforced here. The trains to MetLife for the games will be restricted to World Cup ticket holders. How is that going to be enforced?
So that'll be, that is something that I know New York and New Jersey are working on right now at Penn Station, so that we have sort of a closed loop system to move people in that period of time. And I'm really hoping we can, you know, I've been really on New Jersey Transit and others and, you know, our friends in New York to really compress that timeline as much as possible to move them as efficiently and effectively as possible.
Why does so much of this seem to be coming together at the last minute?
That, you know, I think possibly it's because we've been waiting for a while for the federal government to pass the funding for security to make some of the security fixes that we needed and understand what the DHS funding would look like. But, you know, some of it, I just, you know, I came into office on January 20th and really I just kind of said, look, guys, you know, this is coming, the World Cup, like, let's get this done. So they have moved really rapidly to get this all solidified, but they had already done some work on some transportation bridges that were need for pedestrian bridges and some thinking through some of the pathways. But I think really, like I said, just the demand to say, look, we just aren't going to have the Treasury of New Jersey be a piggy bank for the World Cup was something that was kind of threw a little bit of a wrench into some of the historic planning.
Governor, allow me to be direct here. Was enough planning done by your predecessor so that when you came into office for the World Cup, that enough planning was already in place so it doesn't seem like what's taking place now is last minute?
There had been a lot of preparation and planning done, a lot of work on the security, especially that was really, you know, that's a key piece of how we run a world event like this, right? So close to New York City. So that focus had been done. There had been some transportation routes looked at, but I think really drilling down onto, okay, how quickly can the trains run? How much time is it going to take to move this many people? When are we going to, you know, which days are the actual events going to take place? And looking at the commuting days, all of these details are really coming into focus right now.
Meanwhile, FIFA is fighting back against Mikey Sherrill's demands. FIFA says it has tried to work with the federal government for funding to give host cities to ease the burden. The organization also says it has not heard of any other sports organization or entertainment entity that was required to pay for fans' transportation costs. You can hear the entire Ask Governor Sherrill show at WBGO.org/news. Throughout April, WBGO is celebrating Jazz Appreciation Month. Let's go back to the WBGO archives now for a special Sports Jam interview with acclaimed pianist Monty Alexander in 2022. Your knowledge of boxing and, of course, music is truly magical, and you are a master storyteller, and that's why we had to have you back here on Sports Jam. When we first talked to you, you made the connection between the rhythm of music in both jazz and boxing. And after seeing Sugar Ray Robinson fight in Kingston, Jamaica, where you grew up, you were 12 years old and saw him in an exhibition match. Can you touch upon once again the connection about rhythm and music and boxing and how you see it all come together?
It's a feeling. I was watching the fighters, you know, the skilled fighters, how to be offensive, you know, in terms of boxing, how to attack and how to defend. And a certain kind of artistry was involved. I mean, if you're in good shape and you know what you're doing and you're figuring out the other guy's rhythm as you go along, and if you're on the bandstand and you're playing and the drummer is playing it a certain way, then you got to blend with that too. It just seemed to me like a very, very similar kind of world, you know? And my dad was a boxing fan and he knew the promoter the same way he knew the promoter when Louis Armstrong came to Kingston and I snuck out of school to see Satchmo. So this is one world of his. It's like I'm the kid in the candy store, man. The jelly beans are in the bowl. Which one am I going to take? And boxing and music wasn't jazz so specific. It was just music. Seemed like one world. I got zapped with the thrill of when you see fighters, you know. And I met, in those earlier days, the amount of musicians that I met that were awesome fans about the sport. They knew who and why, you know, guys who came out of the world of Joe Louis. I have all these memories of different musicians I hung out with. And I'd say, let's go to the Garden and see so-and-so. And let's go to Yankee Stadium and see so-and-so. And I was a instigator. So anyhow, going back to Sugar Ray Robinson, I knew he was like one of the greatest of all times, as Ali would say. I met him at that stage of his life when he was close to retirement. I think it was made public. Miles Davis himself's hero, away from music heroes, was Sugar Ray Robinson.
We're speaking with Monty Alexander here on Sports Jam. Monty, since you have really given us such a connection between boxing and music, did any bout ever inspire you to write a song?
No, where are you coming from with these questions? That's off the charts, but that's really appropriate. I am very delinquent in writing songs that I coulda, shoulda, woulda written because I'm a lazy son of a gun, man. I didn't, when they say you got to go to school because they saw I had some kind of talent, and I ran away from the school teacher, guys. I just picked it up. I was watching it, and I know I coulda, shoulda, woulda written songs. I had reason to that. And you're right, boxing was so much something I enjoyed. I could have written the Ballad of Sugar Ray Robinson or whatever, you know.
Here, it's dedicated. Never too late.
You know what? You just put something in my brain. Look out now. Coming with a, you know, Terrence Blanchard, he wrote a whole, like an opera. Couple of our top music talents have, you know, connected with not just Ali, but Hurricane Reuben Carter. You may remember Reuben Carter.
Sure.
Went to jail when he was innocent, we believe. There was, you know, music, the Ballad of Hurricane Carter, you know, but it's not inappropriate, you know. Joe Louis was such an icon of American history and culture that he, you know, when Joe was fighting Harlem, everybody in Harlem, the radio was on the windowsill so that the people in the street could hear the fight when Joe was fighting. He was the great hero, especially for Black Americans, you know?
Lewis measured him right to the body, a left up to the jaw, and Schmeling is down. The count is 5, 5, 6, 7, 8. The men are in the ring. The fight is over on a technical knockout. Max Schmeling is beaten in one round.
But then you had the Irish guys, the Jewish guys that came along, and they, when they fought, everything stopped. You know, me, I turned down jobs when I had a good gig to play somewhere and something no other guy would have done. I turned down the jobs and found a replacement piano player so I could go see whatever boxing match was on that Saturday night, because the fights are always on a Friday or a Saturday, you know. So, and I have these memories of incidents when I got Tommy Flanagan. I begged him to come take my place at Fat Tuesdays. When I had to see Tommy Hearns fight Pepino Cuevas, I went to the fight. And Tommy understood when he went to play the gig. It kept me out of trouble. Let's put it that way.
Nearly 60 years after you moved to the U.S. from Kingston, Jamaica, you have been touring the world relentlessly with various projects, delighting a global audience, drawn to your incredible personality and your soulful message. And you just spent time touring in France, Spain, and Austria, just to name a few. So you've traveled the world and you've played wonderful piano for so many. What was this tour like for you? Because it was kind of return from, you know, what we see as maybe a light at the end of the tunnel for the coronavirus pandemic. So what was this tour? Was it any different for you?
Yeah, it just, you know, it was like when I saw that the job offers had backed off because everybody's scared. They didn't know what's going on with this thing. And I just had to adjust to this new thing called sit back and, you know, twiddle your thumbs and what's next. We're all in that same orbit. What's happening? But next thing you know, the phone start ringing and I get the emails that we're trying to do a festival and we all have to be careful. And I started little by little after about a year and a half. You know, I went to Switzerland and I said, I guess we better wear the mask because we play, you know. What a weird thing to do, but yes. And we did it and we played gigs like that. And we're, you know, it's like this thing is reopening, you know. It was definitely a new discipline of how to find other alternatives. Because when I play, the music thing is not just, oh, I'm going to perform the music. No, I'm getting therapy, man. This music, if I'm having the blues, a bad day, feeling low about something, I know if I go play tonight, goodbye blues. You know, the music is a healing force for not just for me, but people who come into the proximity of what I do, not just me, but other musicians who do it that way. It's not no technical school thing with me. This is like, I tell people, this is like blood, like when Dracula need blood. The Dracula, give me that blood, man. That's how I'm gonna stay in my thing, you know. And musicians like us, we need to express ourselves. It's a real, it's almost an addiction. So during that time, I just had to sit back and accept that this is a world issue here. The world doesn't know what to do. And thankfully, thank God, there's scientists, people that came along and said, well, take the vaccination, the this and the that. So we've had a miraculous return to a little more normalcy. Yeah, but even though this thing has not gone away, we have to be mindful it's still here and be thoughtful when you go to certain crowded places. You don't know. So I still have that ethic, you know. And I still enjoy, you know, what I enjoyed in the past. But I don't throw caution to the wind, you know.
Not to make you separate one country from another, but was there any country during this tour that you got a different vibe from or a reception you didn't expect?
Well, you know what? I think if you're reflecting that to COVID and what happened, I would say that everywhere. You look out into the audience and you could feel the apprehension, you know. But they're trying to live up to their what was enjoyable from 2 years before. Let's go hear this guy play the piano and we'll get a little upliftment. And, you know, and that's my thing, is to bring upliftment, not just to the people, but to myself. I mean, I saw Louis Armstrong when I was 10 years old and this guy got on the bandstand with that trumpet and he said, "Good evening, everybody." And just about that time, everybody started chuckling and laughing. And the world was a world that they don't use very much with our music. Entertainment. entertainment was what Duke Ellington did, the great, great maestro of music. Nat King Cole, he brought entertainment. He didn't bring a school recital. He didn't say, and it wasn't like, you have to figure out what I'm playing, you know, these men. And I saw that. That was like upliftment, uplift the spirit, you know, because everybody gets a little down, you know. He said, tonight, man, I can't wait to go see whoever the artist is. I mean, pop music, you know, whatever. Rolling Stones, we're going to have a ball. There's Mick Jagger doing. And in our world, where it's a little more, I'll use the word, excuse me if I offend anybody, refined. It's more refined. It's more of substance. It's not about that, you know, putting on a show with makeup on your face. And this is just, it's a dignified way to be an animal. You know, you're about this thing. Ah, here it is. And I saw that as a kid. And I bring that, you know, if I'm on a good night, man, I'll tell a joke, a talk. I don't tell people stories. Like I'm talking to you about boxing mostly. But I rebel in getting the mic and start. I wrote this song because, boom, and I tell this story. It goes on for 3-4 minutes. And I say, uh-oh, talking too much. And the people inevitably said, no, don't stop talking. Tell us more, you know? Because I have filled with these memories that I cherish. I really do. I cherish the fact that Frank Sinatra came to me when I was playing somewhere. And Mr. S, he said, hey, kid, you got it. We want you to come to New York. So I came to New York because this man who was one of our kings of entertainment, you know, I met Miles Davis. I met these people and they gave me the tap on the shoulder and I got my confidence go up, you know. It didn't come from Professor Jones at the school. No, it came from life, you know, being around, you know, Ali, being around Evander Holyfield, you know, and I went out of my way to meet these heroes, you know. I mean, they're almost comic book heroes, you know, but they're real people, you know. And I still have that.
You can catch my most recent interview with Monty Alexander on the WBGO YouTube channel. When the NHL hockey team known as the Colorado Rockies moved to New Jersey in 1982, the new owners ran a contest to name the team, and more than 10,000 votes were cast. Not all fans of the New Jersey Devils realized that the team was named after a creature that, according to myth, roamed the Pine Barrens in South Jersey. WBGO's John Kalis takes a look back at the colorful folklore surrounding the Jersey Devil.
The Jersey Devil has been described as a flying biped with a horse-like head, bat-like wings, horns, small arms with clawed hands, cloven hooves, and a forked tail. The myth dates back to 1735 when a woman known as Mother Leeds discovered that she was pregnant for the 13th time. The child was normal when it was born, but supposedly grew wings, a tail, and claws, then flew off to the Pine Barrens.
It's said, by the way, that every 7 years, the Jersey Devil returns to the place in which he was born.
That's from a 1979 New Jersey Public Broadcasting documentary about the Jersey Devil, complete with simulated sound effects of the creature screeching and an original ballad about the poor devil. The documentary included a visit to the area in the Pine Barrens where the Jersey Devil is said to have been born.
There's a strange kind of stillness around here, and the trees and the bushes have so overgrown it, you'd never know that a house once stood on this spot. and that this pile of crumbling bricks, of rotten and falling timbers, are all that remains of what once was the actual house in which the Jersey Devil was born.
There's no such thing as the Jersey Devil.
Brian Regal is a retired history professor from Kane University. Regal says that even though the myth of the Jersey Devil dates back to the 18th century, the legend really picked up steam in the early 1900s, and it happened in the City of Brotherly Love.
It was born at the 9th and Arch Street Dime Museum in Philadelphia in 1907. They're looking for two-headed babies and all that kind of stuff. They're looking for something new. And there had been a few reports of strange footprints and weird screams in the night coming out of the woods, out of the Pine Barrens. And the guys who ran the 9th and Arch Street Dime Museum said, let's make something out of it.
The museum hucksters managed to buy a live kangaroo in upstate New York. They attached fake claws and wings to the poor animal and painted green stripes on it. Then, after publicly declaring that they had captured the Jersey Devil, they put the creature on display. Historian Brian Regal says the cruel method used to get the kangaroo to shriek scared the spectators so badly that some ran out of the museum.
They had a kid behind the curtain so you couldn't see him with a long stick with a nail sticking out of the end of it. And you can probably see where this is going. When the head of the museum signaled the kid would stab the kangaroo with the nail. And the kangaroo, of course, would start screaming and hopping around. And then people would run out. And then they'd bring another group of people in and do this over and over again.
The search for creatures like the Jersey Devil is referred to as cryptozoology, the pursuit of beasts whose existence is disputed or unsubstantiated goes on unabated. Cryptozoologists are out there trying to track down Sasquatch, the abominable snowman, and the Loch Ness Monster. Back in 2008, there was a New Jersey group called the Devil Hunters, but alas, they disbanded and let their website expire. Brian Regal wrote a book titled Searching for Sasquatch, Crackpots, Eggheads, and Cryptozoology. He has studied the phenomenon as a serious academic discipline, but has little tolerance for people who are convinced these monsters are real.
I'm a historian. I'm not a psychologist. So I can't plumb the depths of the human mind for why people believe in stupid crap, but they do.
In the early 1970s, some architects who met at Princeton University built an unconventional-looking house on the edge of the Pine Barrens. One of the locals joked that it looked like the work of the Jersey Devil, prompting the architects to call their new firm Jersey Devil. They went on to become pioneers in architecture's design-build movement. We'll meet the Jersey Devil architects in my next report. For the WBGO Journal, I'm John Kalish.
Oh, me, my old mister, 13th child, a mother leaves. He's come back and he's hunting for something. Wonder what the Jersey Devil needs. Mama, better close your window. Take that peach pie off of the silver. That Jersey Devil, he's got a sweet tooth on it. Never been known to get his fill. But I thought I saw the Jersey Devil up the road and around the bend. Thought I saw the Jersey Devil dancing in his moccasins.
Thanks for listening to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. Join us next Saturday morning at 5:30 for another edition of the award-winning WBGO Journal. In the meantime, stay tuned to the world's greatest jazz and blues station, WBGO and WBGO.org.